Church, thank you so much for tuning in, for worshiping with us, and for listening to these messages. I've really enjoyed these past few weeks just exploring the idea of the current reality of our lives and how we face busyness and hurriedness, and we are so distracted, and that it's causing us to be in spiritual oblivion. It's taking us away from the ability to be present to others, to ourselves, and even to God. But we've been looking and we've exploring some of the practices or some of the disciplines that Jesus embodied throughout his life and that we learn about in the Gospels. And I've really enjoyed going on this journey. And what I'm going to look at today, I'm really excited about this particular practice. But before we get there, I just want to lay some groundwork to unpack it more fully. But I've been enjoying this. I hope you've been enjoying this and gotten something out of it as well. But I want to ask, you know, what gets you out of the bed in the morning? What is it that drives you? You know, all of us have desires. All of us have motivators. I know when I was at college, you know, the desire to get out of bed in the morning to go to a sunrise at the beach, to go and experience life with my friends, to get that assignment done that is due at you know, 12 p.m. that day. You know, I had desires and motivators to get out of bed. And desire is a great motivator. It's the engine of our lives. It's what causes us to propel us out of bed and allow us to function throughout the day, to go out and contribute and make meaning in this world. Desire is a great motivator. But if at any point desire is no longer under our control and instead desire is driving our lives, then we're in trouble. Because when you take a closer look at the dynamics of desire, you realize desire is one thing that is never, ever, ever satisfied. You know, the author of Ecclesiastes had this to write: "Everything is wearisome beyond description. No matter how much we see, we are never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we are not content." Or a more recent poet by the name of the Rolling Stones said, "I can't get no satisfaction." Or Thomas Aquinas, a famous theologian, once was asked this question: what would satisfy our desire? What would it take to feel satisfied? The answer he came up with was this: everything. We would have to experience everything and everybody and be experienced by everything and by everybody to feel satisfied. Eat at every restaurant, travel to every country, visit every city, every exotic locale, every natural wonder, make love to every partner we possibly could desire, win every award, climb to the top of every field, own every item in the world, and the list goes on. We would have to experience it all to ever feel satisfied. Sadly, even if we had access to unlimited funds, time and space still gets in the way of stopping us from experiencing that. So what are these poets and preachers and theologians telling us? They're tapping into the reality that desire is infinite. Desire has no limits. At no point is desire ever satisfied. And the problem is, we as human beings, we are finite. We have all sorts of limits. And because of this, the result is restlessness. In the language of a math equation, think of it like this: infinite desire plus a finite soul equals restlessness. We live chronically with unsatisfied desires. It's like that itch that you can't scratch. No matter how many times you scratch, no matter how hard you scratch, it won't go away. No matter how much we see, buy, sell, eat, experience, visit, we always want more. The question for us as followers, as disciples of Jesus: what do we do with all this pent-up, unsatisfied desire, this restlessness? And I believe, you know, in the language of Jesus, he would say something like this: human desire is infinite because we are made to live with God forever in his world, and nothing less will ever satisfy us. So our only hope is to put desire back in its proper place on God, and to put all other desires in their proper place, below God. Not to detach from desire, as Buddhism might tell us, but to come to a place where we no longer need whatever it is, fill in the blank, to live a happy, restful life. St. Augustine, another famous early theologian in the church, he said, "You have made us for yourselves, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in you." Or Dallas Willard, who I've quoted over these weeks, had this to say, "Human desire is infinite because we are made to live with God forever in this world, and nothing less will ever satisfy us. So our only desire, so our only hope is to put desire back in its proper place on God." Desire is infinite, partly because we were made by God, made for God, made to need God, and made to run on God. We can be satisfied only by the God who is infinite, eternal, and able to supply all our needs. We are only at home in God. When we fall away from God, the desire for the infinite remains, but it is placed upon things that will certainly lead to destruction. Ultimately, nothing in this life apart from God can satisfy our desires. Tragically, we continue to chase after all of this, and the result is a chronic state of restlessness, or worse, angst, anger, anxiety, disillusionment, depression, all of which leads to a life of more hurry, more busyness, more restlessness, more overload, more shopping, materialism, careerism, and a life of more, which in turn makes us even more restless. And the cycle spirals out of control. To make a bad problem worse, this is exacerbated by our current reality, our current cultural dynamic of digital marketing. And our society is built on this idea of accumulation and accomplishment and always getting more, more, and more. Advertising is literally the attempt to monetize our restlessness and our infinite desires. They say we see upward of 4,000 ads a day. 4,000 ads a day, all designed to stoke the fire of desire in our bellies. Buy this, do this, eat this, drink this, have this product, buy more of this, buy the latest tech item. And social media takes this problem to a whole other level. We live under the barrage of constant images, not just from marketing departments, but from the rich and famous, as well as our family and our friends. And Facebook and Instagram, they just curate the best moments. And it's awesome to see these pictures. But remember, we are only seeing the highlight reels of people's lives. We're not seeing behind the scenes. We're not seeing what goes on day to day. You know, this, what we see in marketing, what we see on social media, this ends up unintentionally playing to the core sin of the human condition that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. This sin of envy. The greed for another person's life and the loss of gratitude, joy, and contentment in our own. And when our innate human restlessness collides with the digital age, the result is a culture-wide crisis of emotional unhealth and spiritual death. So I lay out this problem before us, and I've laid out the problem the last few weeks. So is there a practice? Is there something that we can learn from the life of Jesus that is the antidote to all of this, that taps into the rest that we need? And you know the answer, absolutely. And this practice is near and dear to us. It's something that is pretty much in our name, that we try to embody as Seventh-day Adventists. It's this practice of the Sabbath. We are big, we are religious about the Sabbath, and I love this. But at times, I think over the years, we have missed the beauty. We have missed the practice of Sabbath and what it means. And so today, I want to unpack the practice of Sabbath and how it actually helps us find true and full rest, and how it tackles desire, how it tackles these issues that we see before us in our day. Because the Sabbath is as relevant as ever. And for far too long, I think we've been harping on about how it's Saturday, not Sunday, which is true and which I agree with. But there are plenty of sermons about that. So this is not a sermon about that. But this is a sermon about the practice, the beauty, and the importance that we find in Sabbath. Because it's so much more than just a day. It's so much more than just the day we worship or go to church, or the day we, you know, don't do stuff and we take a nap and not feel bad about it. Sabbath is central to the way of life as a follower of Jesus. The word Sabbath in Hebrew is the word Shabbat. And if you'd like to say that, Shabbat, you're saying a Hebrew word. And the word literally means to stop. The Sabbath is a day to simply stop working, stop wanting, to stop worrying, to just stop. But the Sabbath is more than just that day. It's a way of being in this world. It's a spirit of restfulness that comes from abiding, from living in God's presence all week long. You could frame it like this. You got a list of restfulness and you got a list of restlessness. And in restful, you'll feel, you'll have margin, you'll have quiet, you'll have relationships, you'll have enjoyment and clarity and gratitude, trust, love, joy, peace, working from love. Whereas in restlessness, there's hurry, there's busyness, there's envy, there's distraction, there's confusion, greed, discontentment, worry, anxiety, working for love. Which list best describes you? And if you resonate more with list B, it's not a guilt trip. This is, you know, something we all face. And from time to time, our human nature and, you know, our current cultural dynamic sort of makes us fall into list B. We all struggle in this area. No wonder that when we come to the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, that the author writes that we should make every effort to enter into that rest. I love that he says we have to make every effort. Notice the irony of that. You know, we are to work hard to rest well. See, discipline. There's a discipline around the Sabbath. It takes a lot of intentionality. It won't just happen. It takes planning and preparation. It takes self-control, the capacity to say no to a list of good things so we can say yes to the best. Sabbath is the primary discipline or practice by which we cultivate the spirit of restfulness in our lives as a whole. The Sabbath is a spirit of restfulness, like what a soccer practice match is to the real match, or brand practice is to the show. It's how we practice, how we prepare our minds and our bodies for what matters most. And I love this line from Walter Brueggemann. He's a great Old Testament scholar and has a lot to write on the Sabbath. People who keep the Sabbath live all 7 days differently. Sabbath carries over and it impacts every day of our week. To clarify, Sabbath isn't less than a day. It's a whole lot more. It was woven into the fabric of Jesus' weekly routine. Sabbath was central to Jesus, which we see again and again and again in the Gospels. You know, when I kicked this off a few weeks ago, I looked at that invitation in Matthew 11 of Jesus inviting us to come and find rest in him, to take up his yoke. And then chapter 11 ends. But then you jump to chapter 12, which is a follow-on, a carry-on, and there we see two stories about the Sabbath. The flow-on event to find that rest is found in the Sabbath. Sabbath and rest go hand in hand. And I love Jesus' teaching in Mark chapter 2. And so to paint the scene for you, you know, it was a lazy Saturday afternoon. You know, it was a hot day with clear skies overhead. Jesus was hiking through the cornfield with his apprentices, you know, his disciples, like you do. They were mucking around, telling stories, telling jokes, having a good time. It was Sabbath. And this is one of many stories about Jesus and the seventh day. But on this particular Sabbath, Jesus got into trouble with the Pharisees. They took issue with how Jesus and his friends were celebrating the day, royally missing the heart of God behind this practice. And in a loving rebuke, Jesus simply said these profound words, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." So the Pharisees, they tried to be well-intentioned. They had the law, they had the Torah, but they also had what was known as they built a fence around the Torah. And these were additional laws that they had made. And these laws were how they would keep the actual law. And they just kept piling more and more on of what it meant to keep the law. It was missing the heart of the Sabbath. It was well-intentioned, but it missed the point. And Jesus simply reminds them, the Sabbath is a gift. The Sabbath is a benefit. It's not meant to be a burden. See, the Pharisees had made it a burden. It was so hard for the people to keep the Sabbath. They didn't know what they could do and they couldn't do. And I think at times, have we made the Sabbath a burden? Have we made it a day of do's and don'ts? The Sabbath is a gift. It is there as a benefit for us. It was created and designed by God Himself, and it is for us. A gift to enjoy from the Creator, to gratefully receive. And in this one-liner from Jesus, He is tapping back into Genesis chapter 1, where we first find the Sabbath, in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. You know, the story of the Bible begins with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But after 6 days of hard work to get the universe up and running, we read the following in Genesis chapter 2 at the very start. By the 7th day, God had finished the work He had been doing. So on the 7th day, He rested from all His work. Then God blessed the 7th day and made it holy, because on it He rested from all work of creating He had done. Did you catch that? God rested. Yeah, but I'm like more of an extrovert and I just like to stay busy and like I can't. God rested. Yeah, I get the Sabbath thing, but like I work a demanding job and it takes a lot of my time, because God rested. Yeah, but I have like 2 kids at home and it's not really doable right now. Maybe later. God rested. And in doing so, He built into creation, He built a rhythm, a tempo, a beat. God worked for 6 days, rested for one. And when we fight this rhythm, we are going against the Creator Himself. There's something about this seventh-day rhythm of work and rest. We literally look at our calendar, it's built on 7 days. You know what happens when people try to change this rhythm? There are 2 notable events where people decided, okay, we're not going to live to this rhythm. And you know what happened when people tried to change this cycle? One time was during the revolution in France. They switched to a 10-day work week to up productivity. And you know what happened? Disaster. The economy crashed, the suicide rate skyrocketed, and productivity actually went down. Or the most recent real attempt to throw out the 7-day work week was in 1929. When the USSR changed the calendar to a 72-week of 5 days each. The difference was made up with some national holidays which did not fall on normal days of the week. It'd be like having Saturday, Sunday, Labor Day, Monday, Tuesday. Each worker was given one of these days as a day of rest, in which they didn't work. The system was designed to make for continuous work week. At any given moment, 24 hours a day, every day, 80% of the workforce was working, compared with the garbage capitalist system that gave universal weekends. The system proved very frustrating. Most people did not have the same day of rest as their spouses, or friends, or family. Machines broke down for the same reason New York City subways are always breaking down. When a system works 24 hours a day, every day, there's no real time to repair or maintain them. And so in 1931, the USSR changed their schedule to a 6-day week, in which every 6 day was a rest day. This proved not much better, and in 1940, the USSR gave up and went back to a 7-day week. It's been proven, study after study, there is zero correlation between hurry and productivity. In fact, once you work a certain number of hours a week, your productivity actually plummets. Do you want to know what that number is? 50 hours. Ironic, because if you add it up, that's a 6-day work week. One study found that there was zero difference in productivity between workers who logged 70 hours and those who logged 50. Is God speaking to us through our bodies, through the reality around us, through history? God designed the world in a particular way. We ought to listen. What's the point of fighting God? And when we come back to this Genesis account, what does it mean by rested? Why did God have to rest? Was God tired? Was He burnt out? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. God's God. How can He get tired? And like I said, the Hebrew word for Shabbat means to stop. But it can also be translated a different way. And what I love about the Hebrew is that we get big word pictures from their words. See, in any English dictionary, we have between 100 and 200,000 words. We have a lot of words to choose from to paint our pictures. The Hebrew, and so we can be very detailed with our descriptions, whereas the Hebrew, they only have about 7,000 words. And so you got to make up a lot of ground with the words that you have. And so with the words that are chosen with intention, they are painting a beautiful picture. And so not only does this word mean to stop, but it also means to delight. It has a dual idea of stopping, but also in stopping, you're enjoying, you're embracing, you're delighting. So the Sabbath is an entire day to set aside, to follow God's example, to stop and to delight. To delight in the world, in our lives, and above all, in God Himself. Do we use the Sabbath as a day to delight? Dan Adler, he had this to say about the Sabbath. The Sabbath is an invitation to enter delight. The Sabbath, when experienced as God intended, is the best day of our lives, without question or thought. It is the best day of the week. It is the day we anticipate on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and the day we remember Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Sabbath is the holy time when we feast, play, dance, sing, pray, laugh, tell stories, read, paint, walk, and watch creation in its fullness. Few people are willing to enter the Sabbath and sanctify it, to make it holy, because a full day of delight and joy is more than most people can bear in a lifetime, let alone in a week. And all of this is rooted in God. He rested, He stopped, He set aside an entire day to delight in this world. But notice, what did God do with this day? He blessed the seventh day and He made it holy. Two things. So first, He blessed it. In the Genesis story, in this account, three things are blessed by God. To start with, God blesses the animal kingdom with the command to be fruitful and multiply. Then He blesses humanity with the same command, be fruitful and multiply. Then God blessed the seventh day. So God blessed animals, humans, and then a day? What's happening here? It means that the Sabbath, just like an animal or a human being, has the life capacity to procreate, to fill the world up with more life. Life is tiring. Case in point, you probably just sighed from hearing that. Life is tiring. You get to the end of the week, and even if you love your job, you're still worn down on every level, emotionally, physically, mentally, even spiritually. The Sabbath is how we fill our souls back up with life. You know, recently there was a survey done, and this doctor was finding the happiest people on earth. And guess who was near the top of the list? A group of Christians. You might know them because we're one of them. This group of Christians was called Seventh-day Adventists. This doctor noted that they lived 10 years longer than the average American. If we do the math, if I Sabbath every seventh day, it adds up to it, wait for it, 10 years over a lifetime. Almost exactly. So when we say that the Sabbath is life-giving, it's not an empty rhetoric. If this study is to be believed, every day you Sabbath, you are statistically and scientifically likely to get back a longer life. Not only will you live longer, you'll live better. So first, the Sabbath is blessed. Secondly, it's holy. What does that mean? What does it mean that the Sabbath day is holy? How could a day be holy? And I love digging into the world of the ancient Near East in which the Genesis account comes up. And this would have been jarring to the original audience. In the ancient Near East, the gods were found in the world of space, of spaces, in buildings. They weren't found in the space, they weren't found in time. They were found in a holy temple or a holy mountain or a holy shrine. But this God, the Creator God, He's not found in a place. He is found in a day. So if you want to go and meet this God, you don't have to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca. You don't have to go to Stonehenge or any other religious site. You have to just set aside a day in the week to Shabbat, to stop long enough to experience Him. This God is found in a day. So there is a day that is blessed and a day that is holy. A rhythm in creation, 6 and 1. And when we tap into this rhythm that God has given us, we experience health and life. But when we fight this rhythm, when we ignore it, when we suppress it, when we push past it and bully it and make excuses and look for a way to get out of it, we reap the consequences. Consider the mind. We grow lethargic, numb, uncreative, distracted, restless. Emotional unhealth becomes our new normal. Irritability, anger, cynicism, and its twin sarcasm overwhelm our defenses and take control of our dispositions. Or consider the body. We go tired and worn out. Our immune systems start to falter. We miss a step, another cold. Is our nervous system trying to get our attention? The Sabbath is there as a gift for us to find holistic health, to fill our souls back up. And throughout the scriptures in the Old Testament, we find two times God commands the Sabbath day. And I think when we understand the context, it speaks to us. It has so much more meaning. And so the first command is found in Exodus, and the basic premise is rest and worship. And to just paint the setting for you, Israel was camped around Mount Sinai. They are fresh out of Egypt. They were about to become a holy nation, the people of God. But first things first, they need a manifesto of how to live in this new reality. So God laid out the Ten Commandments. God needed to teach his people something. And I love when we understand the commandments in its context. See, they're not a list of laws of what to do and don't do to earn God's favor. You know, God, they already had God's favor. Read the start of the commands. You know, God talks about how he loves his people, and this is like a marriage vow in a sense. But he's giving them a manifesto. He's giving them how he wants them to be his people. Because they had lived as slaves for 400 years. That was their culture. That was their identity. And you don't eradicate 400 years of culture overnight. And so God, through the commandments, is giving them a way to be his people, a way to be a new human, a new way to live. And that's why I love the command. And when we look through Leviticus, you know, if you've ever tried to read through the Bible in a year, you often get to Leviticus and you sort of stop or you skip it because Leviticus is quite a stretch to get through. But when you understand the context, man, it is beautiful. And see, if I was to sum it up, see, God had taken them out of Egypt, but in the commands and in Leviticus, it's God taking Egypt out of the people. God had to take Egypt out of them. And one command is longer than the rest, way longer. And if you were to configure the Ten Commandments as a pie chart, this command takes up 30% of the pie. And what was the command? Remember the Sabbath day. We've got it here, Exodus 20, verse 8 to 11. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your sons or your daughters, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh day and made it holy. Remember that life comes to us as a gift. Remember to take time to delight as an act of grateful worship. Remember to be present in the moment of its joy. Humans, we are prone to amnesia. So God commands us to remember. Notice that key line, a Sabbath to the Lord. This can also be translated as set apart for the Lord or dedicated to the Lord. So that the Sabbath isn't just a day for rest, it's also a day for worship. And by worship, I don't just mean singing songs at church, though that is a great example. Worship is a whole way of life, a life orientated towards God. And take note of this, the Sabbath isn't the same as a day off. On a day off, you don't work for your employer, in theory, but you still work. You run errands, you catch up around the house or your apartment, you pay the bills, you make an IKEA or a Kmart run, and there goes a couple hours. You play, you see a movie, you kick the ball with friends, you go shopping, you cycle through the city, and that's great stuff. All of it. I love that stuff, and I love my days off, but those activities don't make a Sabbath. So on the Sabbath, all we do is rest and we worship. Run it through a grid. Is this rest? Is this worship? And if it doesn't meet that criteria, then hold it off for another day. How can we practice Sabbath? What are your activities? What is rest and worship to you? And again, like I said, our practices are going to be different. Me, a mid-20-year-old single living in the suburbs, is going to be different to how a family with kids practice Sabbath, or again, how a family empty nesters might practice the Sabbath. The important thing is that we set aside time and we find time to rest, to worship, and to honor God. Often we hear the word worship and we assume that it means singing praise songs all day while reading the Bible and praying, which is great stuff, but that's not all there is to worship. Worship is a holistic life orientated towards God. And so expand your list of worship to include things like eating a meal with a group of friends, walking on the beach, walking in nature, walking with your friends. Anything that gears our heart towards grateful recognition of God's reality and goodness. Then the command ended with the why, the driving notion behind the Sabbath. For in 6 days, God made the earth, but on the seventh day he rested. You know, this is the only command of the 10 that has a why behind it. God doesn't say, don't murder, and here's why it's bad. Or don't steal, and here's why that's not a good idea. But for the Sabbath, he gives us a why behind the command. He goes back to the Genesis story, calling his people into the rhythms of grace. In fact, I find it fascinating that the Sabbath is the only spiritual discipline that makes the Ten Commandments. Not church, not Bible reading, not even prayer. Sabbath is the anchor discipline to the people of God. And it's so crucial for us to remember. But then it's also commanded again in Deuteronomy. And I love the command in Deuteronomy. Although it's similar, there's a slight shift. And I love how it's pictured and what we can pull out of this. And so in Deuteronomy, the setting is a little bit different. The setting this time is Israel on the edge of the Jordan River. They're a stone's throw away from Canaan, the promised land. It had been 40 years since Mount Sinai. And things went a little bit wrong and they had to take a detour. Israel hit a 40-year delay. And as a result, Moses had to give the Ten Commandments again to the next generation. And that's what Deuteronomy is. It's a retelling of the law for this next generation that's about to come into the promised land. And so the people that Moses is preaching to, they weren't at Mount Sinai, or if they were, they were too young to remember. So this is a refresher course. But in Moses' second edition, in this 2.0 edition, there is a subtle shift, and it's easy to miss. So let's pay some close attention. Here's the command in Deuteronomy. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son nor your daughters, nor your male or female servants, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, or any foreigners residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and outstretched arms. Therefore the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the seventh day. So there's a few differences in there. Firstly, the first word is different. Instead of remember, it's now observe, meaning what exactly? Think of like how we observe an event, like a big birthday, or when we go on a camping trip, when we go to big camp or a holiday event. We gear up for it. We plan it out in advance. We do all we can to make it special. Approach it with anticipation. The Sabbath is like that. A holiday every day of the week, but without all the stress and the family drama. A once-a-week celebration of all that is good in God's world. Other than that, the command is pretty much the same until we get to the very end, where it's been changed. And not a little bit. It's been changed a lot. This time, the why behind it is, remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arms. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Whoa, that's not a minor tweak. That's a whole different reason, a whole different rationale behind the why. What is Moses up to? And so let's just spend a second here. In Exodus, the Sabbath is commanded and grounded in the creation story. It is in the rhythm that God built into the world, a rhythm we tap into for emotional and spiritual health. That's the reason to Sabbath. But in Deuteronomy, the command is grounded in the Exodus story, in Israel's freedom from slavery to Pharaoh and his empire. there's a whole other reason to Sabbath. Why the change? Well, this is the first generation to grow up in freedom. Their parents were slaves, their grandparents were slaves, their great-grandparents were slaves, and their great-great-great-grandparents were slaves. Slaves to an empire that had been devouring human beings, one brick, one pyramid at a time, for centuries. An empire so ravenous that they had to build store cities just to store all the extra stuff. Egypt was a city built around the culture of more. An empire driven by a lust for more. And just like Egypt, and every empire since, was an economic system built on the backs of the oppressed. To get the lavish, opulent luxury of Pharaoh, you need cheap labor. You need slaves grinding their bodies into the ground until there's nothing left but ash and dust. Slaves don't get a Sabbath. They don't even get a day off. They work all day, every day, until they die. Slaves are subhuman. A line item on a spreadsheet, bought and sold like a commodity, a means to whatever end the rich and powerful see fit. All that matters is the bottom line. And why do I say this? Because Egypt, my friends, is alive and well today. Egypt is around us. We live in the culture of Egypt. We live in the thick of it. We live in a culture of more. A culture of gaping, unquenchable lust for everything. Lust for more food, more drink, more clothes, more devices, more apps, more things, more square footage, more experiences, more stamps in the passport, more, more, more. We have so much crap we don't need. Like Egypt, we build store cities. But instead of calling them store cities, we call them storage units. In Australia, it's a $1.5 billion industry, while in the US, it is a $38 billion industry. And just like Egypt, we're an empire built on the oppression of the poor, in our case, literally. What's more, though, is that we've sort of found a way to do slavery guilt-free. We like to think that slavery ended in 1865, but in reality, we just moved it overseas, out of our sight, out of mind. There are 28 million slaves in the world today, more than were ever trafficked in the transcontinental slave trade period of the 18th century. The odds are that our houses are full of stuff that these slaves have produced. T-shirts, pair of kicks, clothes, the furniture, the clock on the wall, maybe even some of the food we eat. In fact, when economicists draw up an image of our global economic system, they draw a pyramid, and it's called the global wealth pyramid, and this is shocking. Notice at the top is 0.7% of humanity, not even 1% of humanity, and they own 45.9% of the world's wealth. Almost half of the 1% of the population owns 50% of the world's wealth. Those crazy rich people who, you know, drive a car, own a computer, have more than a pair of shoes. At the bottom, a little over 70% of our world with a mere 2.7% of our wealth. The vast swarm of people in Southeast Asia and all throughout Africa, the people who make our socks and our shoes, our smartphones and our lunchboxes, many of them working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day in the sweltering heat of a factory in Vietnam or the cold cotton field in Uzbekistan just to survive, many against their will, still under the boot of the empire. The odds are that if you're listening to this, you're closer to the top rather than the bottom. And that's the tricky thing about Egypt. It's hell if you're a slave. It's not half bad if you're a Westerner. I mean, Egyptian. Now, what does any of this have to do with the Sabbath? A lot. And this is why I love the Sabbath. When we understand it in this context, because it's so much more than just a day. So much more than just a day to argue about Saturday or Sunday. The Sabbath calls into question the empire. It calls into question our desires, our motives. Sabbath hits us deep. Sabbath, as the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann said, Sabbath is an act of resistance. It's an act of rebellion against Pharaoh and his empire, an insurgency and an insurrection against the isms of the Western world. And this is what I love about Sabbath. It tackles globalism, capitalism, materialism, all of which sounds nice, but quickly makes slaves of the rich and the poor. Sabbath is a way of saying no to the empire. Sabbath is an act of resistance. One pastor I know calls Sabbath scheduled social justice. Often when I hear about the overwhelming injustices in the world, and you just have to turn on the news to see, or we look at the growing socioeconomic disparity in our country, and I'm deeply troubled and think, how can we make a difference? What can we do? Well, one thing I can do is do nothing one day a week. I can say no, I can Sabbath. Can you imagine what would happen to our society if all commerce stopped once a week? If 24/7 stores went 24/6, websites didn't receive orders, Amazon warehouses closed for a day, restaurants powered off the oven. Can you imagine what that would do for the poor in our cities? Creating spaces for them to spend time with their loved ones. Not to mention what it would do for the rest for us. If only we could go a whole day without anything. We can by practicing Sabbath, playing our small part in this world and encouraging others to do the same. Sabbath is a way of saying enough. Buying things isn't always bad, but most of us have more than enough to enjoy a satisfying life. As the psalmist said, I lack nothing. That's why under the Torah, all buying and selling was off limits on the Sabbath. This wasn't a legalistic rule that we're now free from. This was a life-giving practice. From the way to break our addiction to the West's twin god of accumulation and accomplishment. Again, these things aren't evil in and of themselves, as long as they don't take advantage of the poor, which they usually do. But there's a limit. At some point, you have to draw a line in the sand and say, I'm good. I don't need another pair of shoes. I don't need another jacket. I don't need another shirt. I don't need another item on my bookshelf. I don't need another display item in my cabinet. I don't need another toy from my garage. I don't need another day at the spa. I have enough. I am enough. What I really need is to enjoy what I already have with those around me and with God. The Sabbath is like a guerrilla warfare tactic. If you want to break free from the oppressive yoke of Egypt's taskmaster and its restless, relentless lust for more, just take a break each day of the week and stick it to the man. Don't buy, don't sell, don't shop, don't surf the web. Don't read a magazine. Oh, that bathroom would be nice upstairs. Just put it all away and enjoy. Drink deeply from the well of this ordinary life. A meal with friends, time with family, a walk in the forest, afternoon tea. Above all, slow down long enough to enjoy life with God, who offers everything that materialism promises but can never deliver, namely contentment. Sabbath is an act of resistance. Sabbath is a way of saying no to the empire. Sabbath is a way of stopping us from becoming the slave driver. You know, in 2018, I went on a shopping spree. I just had this throughout the year. I just had to keep buying more and more and more. You know, I had lost weight, so I made the excuse like, oh, I just need new outfits. They're going to fit better. I need new clothes. But it came to a point where I started buying clothes I didn't even need. I had clothes delivered, and I didn't even wear them, and I was already ordering more clothes. I just kept spending more and more, and I discovered Afterpay, and that was a bad thing to fall into, because then I just bought more and then paid it on a payment plan, and it wasn't a good thing. And I was never content. I was never happy. Like, I got it and I liked it, but then I was already surfing on the web for what's next. And then as I was reading this, and as I was learning more and more about the Sabbath and Sabbath as an act of resistance, I had to come to the point saying, no, I have enough. I am enough. God loves me and values me for who I am. And that's what the Sabbath is about. See, the Israelites, their entire worth was based off what they could do and produce. And through the Sabbath, God was saying, no, you are enough. You don't need more. Sabbath is a way of saying no and a way of saying, I have enough. True restfulness, though, is a form of awareness, a way of being in life. I love what Ronald Reiheiser has to say. He says, so much of our unhappiness comes from our comparing. Our lives, our friendships, our loves, our commitments, our duties, our bodies, our sexuality, to some idolized and non-Christian version of things, which falsely assures us that there is a heaven on earth. When that happens, and it does, our tensions begin to drive us mad. In this case, to a cancerous restlessness. And that last line, cancerous restlessness. Is it living an ordinary life with a sense of ease, gratitude, appreciation, peace, and prayer? Can this be an antidote to all of that? We are restful when ordinary life is enough. So what will it be? That cancerous restlessness? That's old as Pharaoh, always comparing your life to the next person, itching for the next purchase to ratchet, or a healing contentment for an unhurried life, an unhurried, restful life. What if ordinary life is enough? The Sabbath is like a governor on the speed of life. All week long, we work, we play, we cook, we clean, we shop, we exercise, we answer text messages, we inhabit the modern world, but finally we hit our limit. On the Sabbath, we slow down. And more than that, on the Sabbath, we come to a stop. To really enjoy the Sabbath, though, you have to slow down the other 6 days. So you can't go 100 kilometers an hour all week long, running pedal to the floor, harrowing your soul to the bone for 6 days straight, and then expect to slam on the brakes and feel Zen autumn. No, Sabbath needs to carry on into every day. It sets the tempo. We have to find that rhythm, because the Sabbath isn't just a 24-hour time slot in your weekly schedule. It's a spirit of restfulness that goes with you throughout your week, a way of living with ease, gratitude, peace, appreciation, a way of working from rest, not for rest, with nothing to prove, a way of bearing fruit from abiding, not ambition. As that Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann said, Sabbath, people who keep the Sabbath live all 7 days differently. That's why the Sabbath is on day 7, not day 3 or 4. It's not a break in the week to rest up so we can get back to work. It's the climax of the week. It's what the entire week has been leading up to. And I loved, as I was reading and I was researching for this, this one author was writing about how he and his family, the Sabbath is always a highlight for them. And I loved just some of his simple practices, some of the simple things that he did. And on a Friday night, he said they would feast together, and then they would get a cast iron skillet and they would make this cookie dough batch thing. And they'd bring it out of the oven, and then they just pour ice cream on it, and they're just feasting there Friday night, and they're spending time together as a family. Then on the Sabbath day, they sleep in, they rest, they spend time with each other in nature, they spend time with family and friends, they read scripture, they pray, they sing songs together, and they always come together and they talk about their week. And they mention, okay, what was the highlight of the week? And he said 9 out of 10 times, it's always the Sabbath. And it has to take something really special to top the Sabbath, they say. He's made the day, a Sabbath a day, they delight and they enjoy, and it's the best day of the week. And as I practice it more and more, I want the Sabbath to be my favorite day of the week, the one I look forward to, the one that carries me on for the rest of the week. You know, we get to Wednesday, Thursday, I can do this, Sabbath is around the corner. Or when I hit Monday, Tuesday, I can get through this week because I'm resting, I'm living off the Sabbath. Let's practice the delight of Sabbath. I want Sabbath to be something we all look forward to. Sabbath sets us free because it's God's gift to us. It's not there as a burden. It's not a legalistic command, but it's as something to remember and something to delight in. The Sabbath reminds us we are finite. We cannot be constantly on the go. There are limits, and to honor those limitations is to honor the infinite God who rested himself. Made in his image. If God rested, then we too need that rest. See, we are citizens of another kingdom, a kingdom not ruled by the clock and the tyrant of urgencies. God's Sabbath reality calls us to rest that Creator can manage all the concerns. Is this a world we can settle into his rest? So I'd like to know, how do you practice Sabbath? What are some of your practices? What are some of the things that you do? I'd love to hear in the comment section, or you can write to me. And what can we do to make the Sabbath an even better day? How can we practice it? What new things can we try? And I think as time goes on and as we were able to see each other more, I want to practice a digital Sabbath. You know, the last couple of weeks I've been talking about the impact of phones. What if we just switched off technology, including our phones, for a whole 24 hours? What would that do for us and our connection with God? Maybe we can invite the Sabbath in. Maybe you already do this with candles and a prayer and a Friday night feast. Maybe you do this. Maybe it's something worth trying to make the Sabbath a special day, a day that we delight in and look forward to when that carries us throughout the week. Maybe we have a Sabbath box. Put things you don't want to take with you into the Sabbath. We're going to intentionally drop it in. Put our phone, put our credit cards, put our homework, put our work. Maybe we're worrying about something. Write it on a piece of paper and you're going to drop it into that box because we're resting in God today and we're going to carry that rest into all 7 days. Pray together as a family. Say no to some things so you can say yes to the best things. Sabbath is God's gift to us. So let me pray. Lord, I want to thank you so much for this day that you've given us. I want to thank you for your words in Scripture and how they challenge us to be the people you called us to be. I love how you've given us the Sabbath, Lord. And I pray as a church, as a community, that we can honor the Sabbath, that we can see it as a day of delight, as a gift that you've given us to stop from the worries of this world, to stop taking part in the cycle of this world. Help us to honor Sabbath as an act of resistance. I just want to pray over each and every member in this church. I pray that you are guiding them. I pray that you're keeping them safe. I pray that we can be a community that influences the Dandenong city for the better. I thank you for your love, for your grace, for your words of wisdom, and for everything that you do for us, everything you're going to do for us. I pray over each and every family. Pray that Holy Spirit continues to be with us throughout this week. May we be aware of your presence in our lives. May we make that space for you. Continue to challenge and comfort us, Lord. In your name we pray, amen. So now we're just going to sing a song. I just want to thank you for joining and watching us. I hope that you have been blessed by this and you have taken something out of this. So thank you so much, church.